So we're looking at three chapters in a row in 1 Samuel. We continue through this life of David, seeing what we can find here. And we find this theme all of a sudden is revenge, or if you prefer, vengeance. Because David has, it's really interesting when you start looking at these things and you see these themes just leap out and say, look at me, here I am. Because in chapter 24, David has a chance to take vengeance into his own hand. And in chapter 25, David has a chance to take vengeance into his own hand. And in chapter 26, David has a chance to take vengeance into his own hand. You say, there appears to be a theme here. And I titled it Revenge, because revenge is a fun title. But there's no revenge in these chapters. There's almost revenge, but there's no revenge in these chapters because it's not the right thing to do. What is the proper way to emphasize the word revenge, by the way? Because isn't it fun to say, revenge? You know, it's something very satisfying. I mean, revenge, it's satisfying down here. I mean, you feel it. I want it. Payback. You will be sorry you dared to cross me, you foolish human being. Kind of thing. So in these three chapters, we find three prime opportunities for revenge. And how do you pass that up? At some point, don't you say, God put this right in my lap? I might as well, it's a gift. I might as well accept the gift he's given me. It's kind of like you do something like that, but David doesn't. He trusts God who said, vengeance is mine. And he says, Lord, this is in your hands, not mine. So today we're going to take a look at these three cases. And so there's going to be some just walking through the history of it. And again, if you don't like the history, I love the history books. And if you don't like the history, I apologize for that. I know some people really don't. We will move from the history books to Psalm 57, which is, if you'll read the heading to Psalm 57, it starts with this description of the writing of the psalm around David being in a cave hiding from Saul. And you go, huh, that might be appropriate. A prayer for rescue from oppressors, our persecutors, for the choir director sent to Al-Ashtasheth, a miktam of David when he fled from Saul in the cave. Okay, we're going to go and look at that and see what David said in the Psalms about the experience he has in the cave and so on. So 1 Samuel 24 through 26, opportunities for revenge. First chapter 24, Saul is at David's mercy. So where we left David, he had his army of 600 men now. He's got his 600 men. They've saved the city of Keilah. And having saved the city of Keilah, David asks of God, are they coming to get me? He says, yes. Will the city give me up? They say, yes. So he and his men say, okay, let's get out of here. And they go, and they flee to En-Gedi. Now, Saul was returning from pursuing the Philistines. He was told saying, behold, David is in the wilderness of En-Gedi. Then Saul took 3,000 chosen men from all Israel and went to seek David and his men in front of the rocks of the wild goats. He came to the sheepfolds on the way where there was a cave, and Saul went in, this is the way it says in my New American Standard, to relieve himself. If you have a King James, it says something like he went to rest in the heat of the day or something like that, and that's really sweet, but I think this is more accurate. Now David and his men were sitting in the inner recesses of the cave. So Saul is completely at David's mercy. He's got his 600 men. And these caves tend to have little openings, and then you open up, and they get big. And this one is so big that David and his men are back in there, and Saul comes in and doesn't know they're there. And he's not going deep into the cave. He just wants a little privacy. All the other guys, they run around with a shovel. And if they need to take care of business, they have a shovel to take care of business with. When they're done, they cover it up. Saul, he's the king. He says, you guys wait here. I'll be back in a little while. Kind of like dad, right? But the first thing we find is David is innocent of any wrongdoing. Here's what he's guilty of. He's guilty of dodging Saul's spears when Saul tries to hit him with a spear. He's guilty of fleeing when Saul tries to have him killed. He's guilty of delivering Keilah when Saul was too busy to deliver Keilah. And so Saul is chasing him and has the intent to kill David, the innocent man. Saul is bad, David is good, okay? When the bad guy chases the good guy and catches him, the good guy always wins, right? Isn't that the point where da-da-da, you know, and the good guy comes out and wins the day? But now Saul is completely at David's mercy, right? The men of David said to him, "Behold, this is the day of which the Lord said to you, 'Behold, I'm about to give your enemy into your hand, and you shall do to him as it seems good to you.'" Then David arose and finished the sentence. David, the warrior, the leader of warriors, David, armed, takes a spear and walks up to Saul. And they must have carpeting because Saul doesn't hear any of this. How does Saul not hear this? These guys are in the cave talking, right? They're talking in this cave. "Let's go get him." "No, no, don't. Wait. You guys wait here. I'll go." I mean, at what point does Saul not say, "Are there voices in here?" At what point does he not? Somehow they do this and he doesn't hear. And so David, he doesn't pick up that spear. He picks up a spear and he sneaks up, right? And his men are saying, "This is your chance. Get him." And so David goes up there. And I'm really intrigued again because David does not finish the sentence by, "And David slew Saul." It doesn't finish the sentence by saying, "David took the spear and ran it through Saul." David took the spear and cut off the edge of Saul's robe secretly. I want to pull a name and say, "So, Richard, do you think I could cut a piece of your clothing off without you knowing?" it's like, wait, how do you do this? First of all, his spear was sharp, right? Now, with a pair of scissors, I can possibly see that. But with a spear, he has to, like, take that the easiest thing would be to put it on the ground and do this. But he has to do it while it's up there. And somehow or other, he manages to cut off this piece of cloth without Saul being aware of it and then sneak back where he was. And the guys are sitting there going, "David, this was your golden opportunity. We're here hiding from him because he wants to kill you, right? Here's your chance to deal with it once and for all." And think of what David could have done. Had David killed Saul? I mean, here's how I would finish the story. David killed Saul, cut off his head. David walked to the entrance of the tomb or the cave and held it up and said, "He's dead, boys. Go home." And what does that army do? Do they have any reason still to fight? There's no legal choice. Well, I guess now maybe he killed the king, so they can say kill him. But it's like the only reason they're after David is because Saul hates David, and Saul no longer hates David. That issue has been done away with. And he stands there and he says, "He's dead, go home." And the army, maybe they would still attack. Maybe they'd say, no, we're going to kill you. But I think more likely they'd say, "This thing's over, let's go home." And it would all be over, both revenge and self-protection. It's more than merely revenge. It's protecting himself and the men who are with him. This is like in the line of duty or in self-defense. It fits those descriptions, I think. David's men see it as the opportunity. They see it as a gift from God. "David, here's the chance. God has done this." And like I say, somehow Saul was unaware of this conversation. And David just cuts off a piece of Saul. In addition to it, to having to be really sneaky, that had to be really unpleasant. Since COVID, I don't have a sense of smell. And I've taken it on myself to do some things that other people find unpleasant because it doesn't bother me, right? Maybe they'd had COVID. But probably not. David probably had a really good sense of smell. But his conscience bothered him even for cutting off a piece of the robe. Verse 5. And it came about afterward that David's conscience bothered him because he had cut off the edge of Saul's robe. So he said to his men, "Far be it from me because of the Lord that I should do this thing to my Lord, the Lord's anointed, to stretch out my hand against him since he is the Lord's anointed." And David makes a big thing out of Saul being the Lord's anointed. Because Saul was anointed by God. God sent Samuel to prophet, to anoint Saul, and he did. And Saul was the anointed king. He wasn't just the hereditary king. He wasn't just the democratically elected king. He wasn't anything like that. He was the anointed king. And he's still in that position, and God hasn't unanointed him. The Spirit has left him, but he's not unanointed. He's still in that position. And David sees that especially. He says, "I can't do this." And he reveals. So Saul goes out. He goes back down there. David goes up. He stands at the front of the cave, and he says, summarizing it up, he says, "Hey, you were in my hands. look, here's a piece of cloth. And I love to think of exactly where that piece of cloth is missing. And Saul looks back and goes, ooh. <You know? laughs> Who knows? Probably not. Probably down there. But David holds up a piece of the cloth, and Saul says, is that really me? And he looks down, and there's a piece of cloth missing down there. And oh. Anybody who can sneak up and cut a piece of cloth off your garment and you don't know could sneak up and kill you just as fast. And it would have been so much safer. I mean, it would have been done and over. You don't have the chance of him turning around and seeing you and fighting you. You don't have a chance of him turning around and yelling. You don't. He doesn't have the ability to get away. It's so much easier just to kill him. But Saul hears it and he goes home. The end of the chapter. Saul speaking, he said to David, you are more righteous than I, for you have dealt with me while I have dealt wickedly with you. You have declared today that you have done good to me, that the Lord delivered me into your hand, and yet you did not kill me. For if a man finds his enemy, will he let him go away safely? May the Lord therefore reward you with good in return for what you have done for me this day. Behold, I know that you will surely be king, that the kingdom of Israel will be established. So he knows this. Verse 22, it ends up, David swore to Saul, and Saul went to his home, but David and his men went up to the stronghold. And so it ends, Saul goes away, says, you're more righteous than me, I'm going to leave you alone, and he goes away. And David and his men go away. They don't say, okay, peace, we're going to go down and party with you now. They keep their distance. David is not stupid, and he knows that would not go well. And so they go their way, and they go their way, and so we had this great opportunity to get revenge, but he did not. And that could be the end of the story, but it's not. Now, both chapters 24 and 26 deal with Saul specifically, and that issue of the Lord's anointed comes up. But in the middle of those two, we have this middle story of Nabal, the Calebite. There's no anointing thing going on here. So chapter 25, verse 3, introduces these two. Now there was a man in, I'll start at verse 2. Now there was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel, or Carmel. I have always thought this was Mount Carmel, but it's not. There's a town called Carmel by this area called Maon that's not that far from En-Gedi. It's right down the middle of Judea. And that's where this happened, not on Mount Carmel, but in this area, which makes a lot more sense for watching sheep or herding sheep. So there was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel, and the man was very rich. He had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. And it came about while he was shearing sheep in Carmel. Now the man's name, and it goes into this little aside. Now the man's name was Nabal, and his wife's name was Abigail. And the woman was intelligent and beautiful in appearance, but the man was harsh and evil in his dealings, and he was a Calebite. Now, it starts out with the man's name was Nabal. And in English, that doesn't mean anything to us except, yeah, I don't think I want to name my kid Nabal. But to them, Nabal was a name with meaning. And I don't know why he got named Nabal, because the name means foolish. And it's like, okay. Now, some of you dads, I know after child has grown a while, you might say, Nabal. I should have named him Nabal. But when they're little and cute, we don't want to do that to them. When they get older, we say, you deserve this. But it means foolish, and he's described as harsh and evil. And we have his wife, who is a complete contrast, and I don't have a meaning for Abigail, but she's described as intelligent and beautiful. So you have Nabal, harsh and evil, Abigail, intelligent and beautiful. And the story comes along, and it's kind of hard for us to follow what's going on right away, but David expects some payment for services rendered. If we skip down to verse 21, now David had said, surely in vain I have guarded all that this man has in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed of all that belonged to him, for he has returned me good for evil. So just to tell the story before, so we're not trying to put pieces together. David and his men are in this wilderness area, and Nabal's men are out watching sheep in this area. And shepherding in that time and place was a dangerous thing. There were animal predators, and there were human predators, right? Both of which were a danger. It was not that uncommon to lose sheep to wolves or to the occasional lion or bear or to sheep rustlers who would come in and even kill the shepherds or chase them off or beat them and run off with sheep. And David and his men, one of the things he did, we're here, we see this guy with the shepherds here, let's watch over them and protect them. And while they were there, nobody messed with Nabal's sheep. The predators were kept away, whether human or animal. And they did not lose any sheep at all, and nobody bothered the shepherds. And David's men did not bother the shepherds, but rather they protected them. And again, because we're kind of overviewing, we don't have time to walk back and read the whole chapter. Feel free to do it. Double check me on this stuff. We have this. So David and his men, they kind of expect a little bit of they're not exactly in the protection business. they didn't show up and say, hey, we're going to protect you. And he says, I don't need protection. Nothing's going on. And then they start trashing the place and say, now we'll protect you. Okay, I'll pay you. Right? That's what it almost sounds like. But they're not doing that. But David does expect a little respect and tribute in order to pay back for what they've done. So he sends his men, verses 5 through 8, to Nabal looking for a little gratitude. So David sent 10 young men, and David said to the young men, go up to Carmel, visit Nabal, and greet him in my name. And thus you shall say, have a long life, peace to you, and peace to your house, and peace be to all that you have. Now I have heard that you have shearers. Now your shepherds have been with us, and we have not insulted them, nor have they missed anything all the days they were in Carmel. Ask your young men, and they will tell you. Therefore, let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we have come on a festive day. Please give whatever you find at hand to your servants and to your son David. So David's just saying, hey, share a little of the bounty with us and we'll be grateful. That's all he's saying. And Nabal, he kind of responds by, being harsh and cruel, kind of like how he's described. When David's young men came, they spoke to Nabal according to these words in David's name. Then they waited, but Nabal answered David's servants and said, who is David? And who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants today who are breaking away from their master. Shall I then take my bread and my water and my meat that I have slaughtered for my shearers and give it to men whose origin I don't know? Basically said, why should I give you anything? I don't owe you anything. And now I look at this and I go, they didn't have a deal. David didn't walk up and sign a contract with the guy beforehand. He didn't have a handshake deal. What we read, he didn't talk to the guy. He just was out there in the wilderness and said, hey, let's do this. And now he says, give me something. The guy says, no, I'm not giving you nothing. I have no deal. I don't owe you anything. Go away. But the way he did it was so rude and offensive. Yeah, I think that's really the biggest problem. And the guy, by the way, is rich. He's doing these things. And David is bothered by this guy and what he's doing. And at that point, because Nabal's response is not merely, no, I won't give you anything, but it's insulting. He didn't have to be insulting, which, by the way, just a little tip. If you're dealing with a guy who has 600 warriors, be polite. I'm not trying to tell you to be a coward and whatever. I'm just saying, use a little tact. And the response, David's response is he's out for vengeance. Verse 13, David said to his men, each of you gird on his sword. So each man girded on his sword, and David also girded on his sword, and about 400 men went up behind David, while 200 stayed with the baggage. So he's only coming with 400 armed men down to this guy who's sheep shearing. Now, I don't know. I've been at branding time. How many of you guys have been branding? You get there with a group of guys. It's fun to brand, and you get four guys. Five? I imagine you get more for sheep shearing. They probably had 20, maybe 30. Okay, 30 sheep shearers versus 400 warriors. It's like, might want to rethink this thing. And David, this time, he is out for vengeance. He is angry. He says, put on your swords, and we're on our way. And they're on their way down there to do it. And it's really interesting how unwilling David was to lift a hand against Saul, who was trying to kill him, and Nabal, who won't give him food. Right? You go, wow, why is David willing to kill Nabal, who won't give him food, but not Saul, who's trying to kill him? And part of the answer lies in the Lord's anointed thing. I think part of the answer lies in David having time to think about it ahead of time. But I think a big part of the thing is Nabal's insulting manner. Because there's something that ticks you off. When you get ticked off, it's like the scale of the thing becomes inconsequential. What is consequential is your sense of anger. And your sense of anger doesn't say it's a big thing or a small thing. It just says, I'm angry. And David is angry. And so he's coming after this. I think this is due to Saul's manner. To Nabal's manner. But David is off to kill him and all his men. Look at verse 22. May God do so to the enemies of David and much more also, if by morning I leave as much as one male of any who belong to him. So David is going to kill him and every male he finds there. That's his plan. He's going to kill them all. I'm going, the David, you're a little bit out of perspective here. You're talking about killing his shearers. You're talking about killing children. David, because he wouldn't give you food. David is angry. He's got these things going on in his head. And Abigail comes and saves the day. Verses 14 through 17. First of all, she didn't know what was going on. She's intelligent and beautiful. She's not harsh and mean. But one of the young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife, saying, behold, David sent messengers from the wilderness to greet our master, and he scorned them. Yet the men were very good to us, and we were not insulted, nor did we miss anything as long as we went about with them while we were in the fields. They were a wall to us by day and by night, all the time we were with them, tending the sheep. And they're saying, these guys, they took care of us. They protected us. We didn't have to be afraid. It was like the best duty ever. Right? You know, some duty's hard, sometimes it's scary, sometimes, man, these guys made it easy. It was not a problem for us. And then they say, now therefore, no one consider what you should do, for evil is plotted against our master and against all his household, and he is such a worthless man that no one can speak to him. So Abigail gets caught up to date. She hears what goes on, and Abigail, the intelligent and beautiful woman, says, I know what to do about this. Then Abigail hurried and took 200 loaves of bread and 2 jugs of wine, and 5 sheep already prepared, and 5 measures of roasted grain, and 100 clusters of raisins, and 200 cakes of figs, and loaded them on donkeys. She said to her young men, go on before me. Behold, I'm coming after you. But she did not tell her husband Nabal. It came about that as she was riding on her donkey and coming down by the hidden part of the mountain, and behold, David and his men were coming down toward her. She met them. David's complaining about how bad he's been treated. He says he's going to kill everybody. Verse 23, when Abigail saw David, she hurried and dismounted from her donkey. She fell on her face before David, bowed herself to the ground. She basically takes the blame. She says, put the blame on me, please. Let your maidservant speak to you. Listen, and she talks him out of it, and she gives him all this stuff. And David is satisfied by that. But verses 26 and 31 are really key. Now, therefore, my Lord, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, since the Lord has restrained you from shedding blood and from avenging yourself by your own hand, now then let your enemies and those who seek evil against my Lord be as Nabal. And then we skip down to that other verse I mentioned. I have it written down. I just can't find it myself. David responds, verses 32 and 33. Then David said to Abigail, blessed be the Lord God of Israel who sent you this day to meet me, and blessed be your discernment, and blessed be you who have kept me this day from bloodshed and from avenging myself of my own hand. And so we find she says, God has protected you, and you haven't avenged yourself by your own hand. And here David says, thank you, because you prevented me from avenging myself by my own hand. And he's realizing how wrong he was in what he was going to do. And he's so grateful that he has been protected from avenging himself by his own hand. If he had avenged himself by his own hand, then he would have been what he had been accused of being. He would have become it, even though he didn't start out that way. We find this theme, don't avenge it. David, thank you for keeping me from avenging myself. In this case, it's not that David wasn't willing to take vengeance into his own hand, but that he was stopped. And when he was stopped, he realized how close he had come to doing something wrong, and he's grateful. Oh, I'm so glad I did not get my payback. Doesn't that sound so contrary to how we think? We want payback. Don't you dare do that. You're going to suffer for what you did to me. Instead, or worse yet, I'm going to call my lawyer, right? And he says, thank you that I didn't do that. Thank you for keeping me. And so he's grateful for not taking vengeance. And then we move to chapter 26. We have another golden opportunity. Saul is once again chasing David. Don't know what prompted him, except he must have had a bad dream or something. He wakes up and he goes after David. And he's chasing David with his army of is it 3,000 men again? Just a bunch of men. The Ziphites came to Saul at Gibeah. See, is he not hitting? So Saul went out down to the wilderness of Ziph, having with him the 3,000 chosen men of Israel to search for David in the wilderness of Ziph. Saul camped in the hill of Hakalah, which is before Jeshimon, beside the road. David was staying in the wilderness. When he saw that Saul came after him into the wilderness, and the story goes on. So Saul comes out with his army of 3,000 men. So David's got his army of 600 men, and he knows Saul's after him again. So David says, you know what? We're going to put an end to this. And he looks around. He says, who wants to go with me? And Abishai, one of the sons of Zeruiah, so this is one of David's nephews, says, I'll go with you. So they go down and they sneak into the camp. Right? They sneak into the camp, and God has put a heavy sleep on everybody. Nobody's on guard, or the guards are asleep or something. They don't expect anybody to attack them. And David and his men sneak right up to Saul where he's sleeping. And next to Saul is his spear and his water jug. And Abishai says, let me stab him. I'll spear him into the ground. I'll only poke him once. David, I won't keep doing it. I'll only do it once. And David says, no. Right? Verse 5. David arose from and came to the place where Saul had camped, and David saw the place where Saul lay, and Abner, the son of Ner, the commander of his army. And Saul was lying in the circle of the camp, and the people were camped around him. Verse 7, then David and Abishai came to the people by night, and behold, Saul lay sleeping inside the circle of the camp with his spear stuck in the ground at his head, and Abner and the people were lying around him. Then Abishai said to David, today God has delivered your enemy into your hand. You therefore, please let me strike him to the spear with the spear to the ground with one stroke, and I will not strike him a second time. Please, David. Come on, let's be done with this. We're tired of running from this guy. He's not going to stop. David, if he's dead, it's over. Nobody can blame you, David. Please. And you just see, if I'm David, okay. Do you mind? Would you rather I did it? don't want you to have, and David says, no, he's the Lord's anointed. And so they take the spear, and they take the water jug, and they sneak back out of camp. Talk about how wrong that could have gone, right? You get 5 steps out, and someone goes, wakes up, looks, and sees, and yells, and all of a sudden you're surrounded by 3,000 men, and you've got the king's water jug in your hand. It's okay, I wasn't hurting him. Sorry, you're still going to die. And so they go, and they get away. Saul is out after him again. And so we have the mix of danger. I'm sorry, I'm jumping ahead into the psalm here. We find David and his men. David gets away. He gets across the way, and he starts yelling, hey, everybody, wake up. Abner, you're asleep on the job. Someone could have killed the king. David, what are you doing? It's the middle of the night. Leave us alone. Someone could have killed the king. Yeah, someone could have killed the king. Oh, send someone to get his spear. They can pick up his water jug while they're at it. Oops. And once again, Saul responds by going, David, you're a better man than I am. Once again, you had me. You could have killed me. Therefore, I will not chase you anymore. And so it ends that way again. David does not it does not take revenge. Verse 21, then Saul said, I have sinned. Return, my son David, for I will not harm you again, because my life was precious in your sight this day. Behold, I have played the fool and committed a serious error. And so Saul packs up his men, and they go home. David takes his men. And David and his men, they say, you know what? We can't keep doing this. And they actually, at this point, will leave Israel. And that's where we stop the history part of this today. And we turn to Psalm 57. So David has had 3 chances for vengeance, and he hasn't taken them. And he praises God that he hasn't taken them. And you might think the focus of this lesson is don't take your own revenge. Okay, if you walk away with that, that's good. If you not only walk away with it, but then apply it in your life and don't take revenge, that's even better. But when we look at Psalm 57, it gets better yet. So it starts out with a miktam, which again, you know, Spurgeon, he likes to translate that word miktam as a golden apple or a golden secret. It's got the root word for gold in there. Whether he's right or not, I don't know, but I like it. When he fled from Saul in the cave. There's two opportunities for understanding when this fleeing to the cave was. One was when he went to the cave of Adullam, where he went after escaping from Gath. And the other is this one here, where Saul came in and David's men are all hiding in the cave, which makes a much better sense to me. I'm pretty sure that's the one he's talking about here. So we look at this psalm where David is there, and he's hiding in the cave. And one of the questions I ask when I look at this, of David, when he fled from Saul in the cave. When did David actually write this psalm? Because I think there's two options. One, he wrote it while in the cave. If he wrote it in the cave, he's writing it before any of this has happened. He didn't wait till Saul walked in and say, man, I got to write a psalm. Right? He would have written this psalm before Saul ever came in. And it would be a tremendous psalm of God's trust. Or he wrote it sometime later, looking back at that time. And either one is fine. I kind of like the first idea first. The first part of it is written as if seeking protection rather than having already found protection. Either way, this was our scripture reading. Be gracious to me, O God. Be gracious to me, for my soul takes refuge in you. In the shadow of your wings, I will take refuge until destruction passes by. And you look at that, and what a visual picture when someone is hiding in a cave. Because you're hiding in a cave, your soul takes refuge in the cave, right? No, your body takes refuge in the cave, but your soul takes refuge. And the cave becomes a picture of God protecting you for something much more than your mere physical existence. He protects your soul. My soul takes refuge. He's in the cave. Why? Because he's out of sight. And you look at this. He says, in the shadow of your wings will I take refuge. In the dark, right? Underneath, covered, until destruction passes by, until that army of 3,000 people goes by. And the physical picture is there, but David's not talking about the physical picture. He's talking about something far more than that. And a greater danger and an eternal and a spiritual war going on. Be gracious to me, O God, because essentially I take refuge in you, my soul does. In the shadow of your wings, I will take refuge. And what a wonderful thing. You know, as we go through our lives, I'm not a poet. I don't think like a poet, but we should be able to see God at work in our lives. And as we do, we should be able to write our own psalms. They probably won't be the quality of what David did. Some of you can do that. Some of us can't. You know, it looks like a third grader wrote it, which no offense to you third graders, but he's using this picture of what's going on. And he says, be gracious to me. The imagery is powerful and goes beyond protection of body to protection of the soul. And he makes a contrast in verses 2 through 6 between God and between his pursuers. I will cry out to God Most High, who accomplishes all things for me. He will send from heaven and save me. He reproaches him who tramples on me, Selah. God will send forth his loving kindness. My soul is among lions. I must lie with those who breathe forth fire, even the sons of men whose teeth are spears and arrows, and their tongues a sharp sword. In contrast to that, be exalted above the heavens, O God. Let your glory be above all the earth. They have prepared a net for my steps. My soul is bowed down. My soul is, they dug a pit for me. They themselves have fallen into the midst of it. And we have this description of God, and we have a description of these men who are threatening him. And the threat is real, but God is real too. And he cries out to God. He has decided beforehand who he will trust or whom he will trust. And he trusts the one he has decided to trust in spite of what's going on out there. Because it's real easy to say, I trust in God, I trust in God. Uh-oh. Okay, I've got a spear here. and I'm not afraid to use it. He says, no, I trust in God. I will trust in God in spite of what's going on there. The enemy is out there. Among those who breathe forth fire. Now, I don't think he's trying to envision something physical and real there, but he's depicting how great the danger is. My soul is among lions. I must lie among those who breathe forth fire. These are greater than me. They are more powerful than me. I am not able to deal with this myself. But be exalted, O God, among the heavens. And we have this, I will cry out to God. His enemies are described. We have destruction in verse 3. verse 4 there. We have the destruction in verse 4. Lions, fire breathers, teeth of spears and arrows, tongue a sharp sword. They dig a pit for him. God, on the other hand, is providing refuge. God is his protection. God accomplishes all good things for him. God saves him. God sends forth his loving kindness and truth. God's glory is above all the earth. And it's too easy to look at the enemies and the pursuers and the people who threaten us. And instead, David turns and he describes God. And the describing God, by contrast to his enemies, does not result in something as small as vengeance being taken. It doesn't result in something as small as David getting peace. It results in David praising God. And what David's relationship with God grows stronger because of his response to the threat that he faces. And that's what we find, because verse 7 through 11, again, this is something I emphasized a lot the other day, is his situation has not changed. He is still being chased. If he's still in the cave, he's still in the cave hiding. If it's after the cave, he was still in the cave hiding. And he ended up fleeing the country to get away from Saul because the threat had not changed. But he still finds himself praising God. My heart is steadfast, O God. My heart is steadfast. I will sing. Yes, I will sing praises. Awake my glory. Awake harp and lyre. I will awaken the dawn. Yeah, by the way, to awaken the dawn means when the dawn comes up, you're up praising God. Right, I will awaken the dawn. It's not waking me up. By the way, I'm one who the dawn doesn't even wake up. Right? No, he says, I will awaken the dawn. I will give thanks to you, O Lord, among the peoples. I will sing praises to you among the nations. He's saying it's going out. It's not limited to here. I'm not keeping it here. It's going out to everywhere. I'm hiding in a cave right now, but my praise to you, Lord, is everywhere. I will, for your loving kindness is great to the heavens and your truth to the clouds. Be exalted above the heavens, O God. Let your glory be above all the earth, says the man hiding in a cave from a king with 6,000 or 3,000 men. God is his protection. He accomplishes all things for him. God saves him. God sends forth his loving kindness and truth. His glory is above the earth. It does say the pit diggers will fall into their own pit, but that's otherwise there's no mention of vengeance in all the rest of this. There's no mention of God taking vengeance, of David getting vengeance, of him being avenging. You know, why is it we trust God with vengeance? Because aren't we glad that God did not execute on us the vengeance that we deserve? And we may be Jonah and say, but Lord, I don't want them to receive mercy. But Jonah's usually not the role model we want to follow. We want to follow someone who actually accomplishes God's work with a willing heart. You know what? Vengeance is important. You know when vengeance is important? Vengeance is important when your eyes are on those who wronged you. And as long as you are looking at that guy who did that thing to you, Bethany told me about a friend of hers who had a friend with a new car. And she wrote a note and stuck it on the car by the door, said, sorry about the scratch. There was no scratch. And I heard that and I said, and it went back. She went back and told him the next day and she thought it was funny. He still didn't. But, but I thought, oh, I so want to do that. That sounds like so much fun. And as long as your eye is on the guy who left that note, it's like, I don't care if there's a scratch or not. You're going to pay for that. Because how many of you immediately started thinking about what you would do in response? No? You guys are all better than me. Because for me, man, that puppy escalates and you're in trouble. And what do you know? As long as your eye is on that person, vengeance is really important. But when your eye is on God, vengeance becomes irrelevant. It's just not part of the picture because your eye is on God. And what we find him doing here is he's not even just seeking vengeance. He's not seeking vengeance at all. He's trusting in God to take care of him first in the danger because he's in a real danger. And as he does that, vengeance falls out of the picture and is just not necessary for him to do. The passage in this psalm is based on the passages, those three we looked at, even though the psalm was dealing with the first one, not the other two, deal with not the passages in psalms, the historic passages, deal with taking vengeance or not taking vengeance. But the psalm that he built out of it, in this whole back frame of opportunities to take vengeance, is trusting God, turning to praise in God, and vengeance becomes irrelevant. How do you measure the distance between seeking vengeance and praising God? That doesn't feel like a straight line thing to me. I mean, a straight line says seeking vengeance, not seeking vengeance. That's a straight line. A straight line might be seeking vengeance and working for the good of those people. That's a straight line. But from seeking vengeance to praising God, that doesn't feel like a straight line to me. And yet it's easy to see that it works. It's easy to see when we look at this, because what do? We give it to God, we praise God in the midst of this, and it just, like I say, it falls out of the picture. Truly trusting God, if you are trusting God to take vengeance for you, that is a little bit selfish. That is a little bit still focusing on the person who did it. But trusting God to take care of you regardless of the situation, vengeance just falls out of it. What do we walk away with? Seeking revenge is foolish and unprofitable. It's selfish. It doesn't accomplish anything good. All it does is escalate it. And frankly, in all honesty, while at the same time I think I was right when I said he kills Saul, everybody else walks away, says this is over. Saul had several sons. Jonathan, the crown prince, the one next in line to be king, he was David's friend. He would have yielded the throne to David. But there is going to be a civil war. It's probably 2 weeks away. The civil war in Israel over the kingship of Israel. It's going to happen because Saul's sons want it. And so had David simply taken vengeance, it wouldn't have ended the issue at all. It would have escalated it. It would have brought things to a pitch, and David would not have looked like the good guy. And I don't think he thought all this through. I think David is being more noble than that. But seeking revenge is foolish and unprofitable. It does not work. If we are wise, the same situations that can get us into this cycle of vengeance and payback, it can grow us closer to God. It can bring us to praising God. It is a much better conclusion to a bad situation. We all have opportunities to take revenge. We all have opportunities that might cause us to want to take revenge. Sometimes we have opportunities to make it happen. Don't. I mean, first of all, just say forgive the guy. But not only don't take revenge, but pray to God, seek him, praise him, use the same thing because you're leaning on him to grow you with him. Let's pray. Father, I thank you. I thank you that we live in a world where, in spite of what's going on, you can use it for our good. Father, I thank you that you can use something like vengeance to grow us into the kind of people you want us to be. Mm-hmm. That you can use vengeance to grow us to love you more and seek you more. Lord, I ask that be what you do in our lives. I pray in Jesus' name.